I want to say something about that song and that sound, but I don't know what to say that would only cheapen it. Magnificent choir. We are having visitors every Sunday. I want those visitors to know that they are warmly, warmly welcome in this place. I hope you can tell how happy we are to be here and how determined we are to create in this place a house of God that will serve not only ourselves, but this neighborhood. If you say to a child, let's go to the zoo, there are likely to be some special requests. Let's go see the monkeys. Let's go look at the lions. I want to see the snakes. The request you probably will not hear is this one. Take me to see the sloth. I want to see the sloth hang from the tree. Crowds don't stay long around the cage where the sloth lives. No one makes a cute, cuddly, stuffed animal that looks like the sloth. I suppose because the sloth simply doesn't do anything to endear itself to us. In fact, it doesn't do much of anything. It hangs upside down and moves so slowly you can't be sure it hasn't died while you were watching. I read a piece about the sloth some weeks ago in the Smithsonian magazine, and I was interested to notice that a man from Wichita named Charles Maple, maybe someone here will know him, had written in to say that he had a friend with a pet sloth. Once down in Trinidad, a sloth with a partly green coat. Mr. Maple said it moved so slowly that he thought it had been in a race with green algae and the algae had won. Now, obviously, no one relishes being compared to this creature, but in our series on the seven deadly sins, we come this morning to slothfulness, to laziness, and lethargy, apathy, and indolence, a kind of pathological torpor which slowly turns into so what, don't wake me up, I can't be bothered. The kind of weariness expressed in the opening verses from Ecclesiastes, which Andrew Wallace read to you a little while ago. If you've ever wondered where the old Puritan work ethic came from, you probably need look no further than the Jewish and Christian scriptures. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber. That's a typical warning from the book of Proverbs. And Paul in the New Testament is even more direct. The man who will not work shall not eat. Adding, we mention this because we hear that some of your number are idling their time away, minding everybody's business but their own. Paul, by the way, is not striking a blow at the modern welfare system. The Bible is never concerned with unemployment that grows out of a complex economic system. It simply assumes that there will be work for anyone willing to work. Its rebukes are for people too lazy to take jobs which are available. And on the other side of the coin, it constantly glorifies the dignity of work. Unlike the Greeks, profiting from the use of slaves, who argued that manual labor was to be left for them, Aristotle's perfect man would not soil his hands with labor. But not so for the men who wrote the Bible and considered a six-day work week to be the rule. When they described creation, they pictured a God who worked and who on the seventh day rested from all his labor. It never occurred to them to imagine a God too perfect to work. In New Testament times, even a rabbi was expected to learn a trade and support himself. Paul was a tent maker, Jesus a carpenter. No wonder Americans were reared on a gospel of work, being told in childhood that Satan finds some mischief still for idle hands to do, and reciting Longfellow's "Let us then be up and doing." They got a gold star in Sunday school for declaiming that vigorous challenge from another part of Ecclesiastes, "Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might." In fact, some of them got positively drunk on the gospel of work. Henry Ford, whose personality might have profited by a change here and there, wrote like some fervent evangelist that none of us, I'm quoting him, none of us has any right to ease. Work is our sanity, our self-respect, our salvation. Through work and work alone may health, wealth, and happiness inevitably be secured. Well, he oversimplified things, of course. As hard-driving, highly successful people have a way of doing. To hear him, you would suppose industry to be the highest single virtue in life, and poverty always a disgrace, and always the result of pure, willful idleness. I hope we know better than that. Work is not the panacea for every problem, and poverty is certainly not a punishment inflicted only upon the lazy. In fact, ever so often we need a cranky fellow among us like Thoreau, who refused to be hustled, refused to join the mad scramble, and who even saw benefit in a goodly measure of contemplation. He said, "The man who does not," and he was complaining when he said this, "the man who does not take himself at once and desperately to sawing is called a loafer, even though he may be knocking at the doors of heaven all the while he meditates." Meditation may be more valuable once in a while than cutting wood. Brought up as I was on the unmitigated gospel of work, I'm grateful to Thoreau. I have a tendency to feel guilty if I'm not whizzing madly around in the name of that gospel. One of my own children informed me triumphantly one time that my illness had been diagnosed in his sociology text. "You are," he said with obvious relish, "a workaholic." So I stood a little closer to him, thinking it might be possible to transfer a mild case of that. But all this about work and laziness is only a part of what the old churchmen meant by this character trait called slothfulness. For them, it was a rejection of purpose, a denial of the opportunities for joy in life. They called it a sad dejection of spirit, in which a man feels out of sorts with God, the world, and himself. An acute and universal boredom. Nothing is any good. Nothing gives any pleasure. It was that condition a modern poet has described this way: life is not lost by dying. Life is lost minute by minute, day by dragging day, in all the thousand small uncaring ways. And millions now living are already dead. Now, I'm not sure we should call that kind of mood a sin, since we can't always control our feelings. But the medieval church called it a sin anyway, and said it was deadly. For them, it was one of the worst things in the world. Boredom, apathy, the personality trait that lets the sermon be preached before it has been made as good as one's talents can make it, that lets the book be written sloppily, the class taught carelessly, the work done poorly, the meeting chaired without even a moment's preparation. A little more Geritol won't really help, or one a day plus iron, because this is a weariness of the soul. It happens sometimes when you have worked just long enough to find that certain things can be drudgery, and not long enough to discover that there may be something on the other side of drudgery. A boy asked me in the classroom the other day, "Are we going to read all of the essays in this book?" I said, "Yes, why?" He said, "I was hoping we could just pick out and read the interesting ones." And I think out of 50, he would have found two. It's a comment you hear often from children brought up on television and used to constant entertainment. You have to explain what William Sande said to his Oxford classes, that 3/4 of all the honest intellectual work in the world is unrelieved drudgery at first. That is, one labors along in tedium, wishing she were somewhere else, but faithfully doing what has to be done, and then suddenly the mind catches fire, inspiration comes, the discovery is made. For most of us, there is no shorter, sweeter road to it. If we sit waiting for the manna to fall from heaven, we usually wind up starved. An old Scottish preacher went into the pulpit of his church in Edinburgh one day and said to his people, "I often wonder, as I go on working among you, if you ever attach any meaning or make any application to yourselves of all those commands and counsels of which the scriptures are full, to be up and doing, to watch and pray, to fight the good fight of faith, to hold the fort, to rise early and even by night, and to endure unto death. Against whom," he asked them, "and against what do you fight? What fort do you hold?" How would we answer? What do we think is worth defending? What means enough to us that we would fight to save it? If the honest answer is nothing, then we've made it into the list of the deadly 7. You know, people through the centuries have talked about something they call the Antichrist, trying to come up with some monstrous human being or group that fits the bill. I think nothing can be found that is more truly anti-Christ than the so what people, the apathetic, the lethargic, the listless, the uncommitted, who are, after all, his polar opposites. Why else is Christ even remembered, except that he cared so passionately that he was willing even to die for an idea? It's strange to me how Christ is cut up into little pieces, and how each group takes the piece that suits its own purpose. I remember in the 60s how the Flower Children recalled so gladly that he had spoken of the lilies of the field and the colors of the sunset, and who therefore decided to make a gospel of that and believed that they were truly his if they sat in a meadow all day and meditated. They were partly right. We needed a corrective. It was just the proportion they got wrong. They forgot another word of his: I must work while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. You must forgive me, but I can never avoid speaking at some point directly to us who are the church, because the church is so much a part of my life's work, and because always I have a lover's quarrel going with it. Are we here this morning out of some vague combination of social forces? A little guilt, maybe? The need to appear decent, or because free of mom's influence, free from all ulterior motives, we deeply believe in something that is not peripheral but central to our lives? Christianity is not a petition awaiting more signatures, which is what membership sometimes means. It is an assignment awaiting willing students to take the course and to discover that it's not what we know that brings us grace, but what we do because of what we know. The world has no room for more people who don't care. Churches get no profit when they bring in members who only plan to be bystanders. It's all right to look for what a church can give you. It's all wrong unless you plan to give it something back. People who join a church in the hope of finding serenity and peace make a terrible mistake. There is a peace to be found, a peace promised, but it's the peace one discovers in knowing what's important and finding out the joy of working at it. What we are truly ordained to, ladies and gentlemen, is unrest. Dissatisfaction with the world as it is, because it is not good enough. Dissatisfaction with ourselves in the new knowledge that we could be so much more. In the novel Waiting for Godot, Vladimir asks Pozzo, "Where are you going?" Unwittingly, Pozzo gives the Christian answer, on.